Welcome to the EDUCAUSE 2010 Annual Conference Podcast. This podcast features a session from the conference by Larry Smarr, Director of CALIT II at the University of California, San Diego. His session is entitled End-to-End Optical Fiber Cyber Infrastructure for Data-Intensive Research, Implications for Your Campus.
I'm going to talk about the implications for our campuses that the exponential increase in data, particularly from now scientific instruments spread across your campuses, is going to imply. You know, the shared internet is great if you are dealing with megabyte or smaller objects, but the last time somebody put a 10 megabyte attachment to your email, chances are it doesn't get through. If you try to move around the natural gigabyte to terabyte size objects on a 10 megabit per second shared internet, it takes 10 days to move a terabyte object. And so this is why we're looking at building a high-performance cyber infrastructure parallel to and often using the same technology as the shared internet, but where individuals can actually get 10 gigabits per second, 10,000 megabit per second pipes in which a terabyte file moves in about 10 minutes. So I'm going to talk to you today about four different components of this emerging high-performance cyber infrastructure. This isn't a theory. It's well-practiced, but not that many campuses are currently engaged to be able to be part of it. We're going to talk about the optical networks themselves, the need to scale up the visualization and analytics, what an end-to-end 10 gigabit per second network looks like and used for applications, and then what do you have to do to get this capability on your campus. We'll start with the optical networks. One of the things I find very strange is that a lot of times CIOs will come up to me and they say, well, you know, what do you mean giving 10 gigabit to an individual user? You know, we have 30,000 users or something. Nobody could use that kind of speed. Well, let's look around the world. In Japan, I have a conference hosted by NTT Innovation Labs, the Bell Labs of Japan, every year at CALIT II. And this is a picture from already a year and a half ago. And this shows over the last 5 or 6 years, the growth of fiber to the home, fiber into the home, not to the curb, but into your home, your own personal fiber. And you'll notice that this is ADSL. Now, in a developing country like the United States, we don't even have this. This is getting 40 megabits a second into the home, way beyond any DSL we have. And yet the users are declining because that's not good enough for them. And in fact, they're going to the fiber to the home, which starts at 100 megabits a second to each user and goes to a gigabit per second. And this is just to normal citizens. If you look in Australia, which I've worked very closely with the government of Australia, they have committed to the national broadband network, which is going to connect 93% of all buildings, all houses in Australia with fiber, starting with 100 megabits per second. In particular, in Tasmania, the little island off of Australia, that's where it started. They actually have this fiber there now. I'm working with the premier on the applications of it. And everybody else in Australia gets 12 megabits per second from satellites or wireless. I'm in La Jolla. I've got cable. I don't get 10 megabits per second. So the United States has fallen way, way behind the power curve here. This new platform of fiber in Australia is, think of it as an iPhone. It's a uniform infrastructure of fiber on which the retail services are now going to be able to be competed for, independent of having to worry about getting their connectivity there. Very different model. Dedication to this was $43 billion. It's the largest infrastructure project in the history of Australia for anything. If you scale that up by the fact that Australia has the same size country as we do, but 1/12 the population, that would be something like $700 billion that we would have to invest in the U.S. In our stimulus package, we put $7 billion. If you look around the world, this is what you see. By 2013, only 3 years from now, there'll be 130 million households with fiber to the home, most of them in Asia, and it's growing at 30% a year. I guess my point is, if ordinary citizens are getting this, aren't our advanced researchers supposed to be ahead of this somehow? That's why for the last decade we've built out the Global Lambda Integrated Facility, which uses 10 gigabit per second clear channels to most of the major computer science and cyber infrastructure research labs around the world. This is just the Pacific side of it. Think about it this way. On this platform that's parallel to the regular one, in other words, through the fiber, you know, you can have different channels on the fiber, different wavelengths, and you have one wavelength, and it's your campus 10 gigabit shared backbone, right, for 30,000 users. And the next wavelength over and the next one, and the next, and the next are channels that can be on demand made available to individuals. It's got a huge bandwidth, so you can put high definition and even digital cinema images that lets you do telepresence on a scale that you're not used to. It allows you to hook in the streams from high-speed instruments, and it means having campus optical switches that can link to the optoportals and to the different instruments, and I'll show you how that's done at San Diego. The NSF funded this project called the Optiputer that I was principal investigator of for most of the last decade, one of the largest computer science research projects in the United States. What we did is say, let's just go to the end of the rainbow, let's just build this thing out, and then get people use it for applications, particularly in medical areas, geophysics, oceanography, and so forth, and then see what's needed. Well, the first thing we realized is PCs like this are system engineered to impedance match the shared 10 megabit per second internet just fine. But if you're going to go up by a factor of 1,000 and the data coming in every second, you better be scaling up your local storage, compute, and visualization. And so we said, well, we noticed everyone's got Linux clusters locally. They just forget to buy the screens when they buy the PCs. So if you put the screens in, then you develop all the software that allows you to use that much larger area as a single PC, you have what we call an optoportal, and it's a windowed environment that can have multiple HD channels, a video coming in, as well as very large images that are being looked at. There's two OSs for this. Sage, that came out of the Electronic Visualization Lab at the University of Illinois Chicago, and CGLX, the Cross-Platform Cluster Graphics Library out of Cal IT2 and UC San Diego. And you can see from the maps that these have been deployed all over the world. They're all built out of just commodity PCs. Go down to Best Buy, Fry's, pick out your best deal, bring them home, go to our wiki, and then you can just set it up, download the software, and be going in a few hours. This is one of the largest in the world at Cal IT2. It's a third of a billion pixels. Each of the monitors, each of the LCDs are 4-megapixel screens, and it's driven by about 18 Dell dual NVIDIA card PCs tied together with 10 gigabit Ethernet. It allows you to look at a vast amount of information simultaneously. Now, there's a new version of these LCDs coming out that's only 7 millimeters glass to glass, so you get a much more seamless environment. On the other hand, the monitors are only a megapixel, which is basically the same as your PC, because this is being driven by the commercialization of digital signage, and so there's a big market that we benefit from behind that. But you can see that it actually is a much nicer environment. You can also do this with head tracking and 3D stereo. This is what we call the Next Cave. This is a very large one that we built for Saudi Arabia, 22 million pixels in 3D stereo, and it, as you move your head around like this, it's tracking your head, and so it's changing the computer graphics in real time. So that's very good to visualize the data, but as we get to so much more complex projects that we're working on, they're not only interdisciplinary, they're interinstitution, and so the need for collaboration while you're looking at this complex data is very important. And so one of the things we developed in the OptiPeter project was the OptiPlanet Collaboratory. Here's it in use. This is at Cal IT2 at UCSD, and what you see is Saudi Arabia, Chicago, and San Diego involved in a joint analysis of a building that was being built and the visualization systems that we designed. Here in the auditorium at UCSD is a digital cinema, which is 4 times the definition of HD. So that, in other words, HD is 2,000 by 1,000 pixels, so 2 megapixels per frame. It's the digital cinema, which is the standard for replacing film that these studios have come up with, is 4 of those. So it's 4,000 by 2,000 pixels or 8 megapixels per frame. Here it is. You can see live the collaboration. Here is this Richard Weinberg at Cinema School at USC, and he's an amateur microscopist, so he's put a 4K camera on his microscope. We're looking at critters that live in a drop of water out of the pond, and then he's talking to us while we're all watching what he's seeing on his monitor, we're seeing in the monitor here, but with a big audience. We use digital cinema because digital arts have always been one of the things I've used, because the digital artists tend to figure out what the new technology is useful for long before the computer scientists and physical scientists do. And so once the digital artist at Cal IT2 got a hold of this, they said, well, this is cool. Let's just go down to Brazil and set up the first tri-continent premiere of a digital movie. In Sao Paulo, they helped put the local fiber in place, like we'll talk about on the campus. And what you can see here is that this is from the auditorium in Sao Paulo, Brazil. That's the actual film director answering questions to our division director, who's live from Cal IT2. Our digital cinema colleagues in Keio University in Japan, and then that's the audience. So there you're streaming 4K. The movie was streamed one evening, and then the next morning you divided the four HD screens up to actually have a talkback. So that's the kind of collaboration capability that this allows for. But what about actually doing high science, cosmology, for instance? Well, I've worked with Mike Norman for 30 years. He's now the director of the San Diego Supercomputer Center. And we got talking about this, and I was on the Department of Energy's Advanced Scientific Computing Advisory Committee, and I just heard that DOE's net, ESnet, they're going to 100 gigabit per second backplane. And I said, well, fine, who do you have end-to-end using DOE remotely, you know, using DOE supercomputers at 10 gigabits? And the answer was nobody. Everybody thinks their job is just their piece, right? So, like, the DOE guys that run the supercomputers, you know, cycles are being chomped. That's good. That's the end of their job. The ESnet, all they got to do is get from the DOE sites at best to the campus border routers, and then their job's done. It's nobody's job to help an end user get end-to-end all the way from their laboratory to the remote resources. So Mike has about 5 or 6 million CPU hours on several of the large petascale class machines in the country doing evolution of cosmology. And so he's also built an optoportal next to his office that he can analyze, which you see him here analyzing the visualization of these cosmologies. And these individual cubes, you know, are thousands by thousands by thousands. I mean, they're gigantic amounts of data. We decided to show that this could actually be done. And so we went to Oak Ridge, which is the NSF TerraGrid supercomputer Kraken, which is a Cray XD5, and linked it over 10 gigabit fiber optic to Argon. Argon has a NVIDIA supercomputer for visualization, and so this has 200 NVIDIAs, if you can imagine, for rendering. And so as the cosmology would, you know, one time step would be finished, that cube of data would be sent to Argon, the movie would be being made, the visualization, and then that was sent over the 10 gigabits to SDSC, where it was visualized on Mike's OptiPortal. And so now this is clearly an end-to-end 10 gigabit per second. Now you might think, oh, well, that was easy. Well, this took somewhere between 6 and 9 months after we had Ping working to really get it up to getting the, say, 9.6 gigabits per second out of 10 to the end user. It started off maybe 10 megabits. And this is a problem because since it was nobody's job, nobody looked at the routers at each point to make sure they were set up right, their firewalls, or all this stuff. And so, you know, we're doing this just to show it can be done. But what I've been talking to a lot of CIOs and TerraGrid for several years now is we've got to elevate this to where we work together to have best of breed and share what can be done so we can set this up more generally. Robert Grossman is head of the Open Cloud Consortium. And, you know, clouds are emerging at the same time, but usually you think of clouds as being connected with the shared internet, but you can connect them with these 10 gigabits as well. Here is an example of what can be done. I'll just show you the test bed. There's a rack. There's 9 racks distributed between Johns Hopkins University on the East Coast, University of Illinois Chicago, and at Starlight, which is the interchange in Chicago, and then at Cal IT2 in San Diego. And these are all connected by these 10 gigabit clear channels. And then you can look at all kinds of things like Hadoop and Sector and so forth for these very large sorting algorithms. This is TerraSort, so you've got 10 billion records. So that's a terabyte, 1.2 terabytes. But the data, instead of just putting it all in one rack, you know, at one physical location, we spread it out. We spread the fundamental data. In other words, not copies of the data, but the data itself was spread out over these 4 sites. And what we found is we were able to sustain 5 gigabits a second. And the amazing thing is that the time to do that sort was only 5% longer than if the data was all in one computer at one physical location. This kind of work opens the door for a whole new world of applications that we're not thinking about today because we can't get the data back and forth. Well, as a result, in 2008, Sphere, which is like Hadoop, except it's optimized for this high-speed environment, won the bandwidth challenge at supercomputing. And in 2009, Sphere was able to maintain 100 gigabits per second over multiple optical channels across these 4 distributed things and won the bandwidth challenge there. This, of course, is of quite a lot of interest to things like not just campuses, but banks and other financial institutions and so forth that have these large data sets. The biggest change in the last probably 20 years has been the arising of these massive clouds, Google, Amazon, Yahoo, Microsoft, and so forth. The more you get into it, the more you realize realize this is just way beyond anything we've ever seen before in its capability. And so I talked to Werner Vogels, who's the CTO of Amazon, and I said, look, why don't we do this experiment to see if we can actually put a 10 gigabit per second into Amazon's computing EC2 and storage S3 services. Because I'm on the board at Scenic, we were able to get Scenic and the Pacific Northwest Gigapop to agree to do this. So anybody who's connected by Scenic or the Pacific Northwest Gigapop can take advantage and try this. And I'll just give you two early examples of this. The reason I'm telling you this is when we get to what's going on the campus, the consolidation from the way your world works now on the campus, where you've got all these clusters and digital foxholes spread over your campus, to consolidating that is going to go on over the next few years. At the same time, the rise of the cloud is happening. And so you're going to have to think about what you keep on the campus and what you put in the cloud at the same time. And that's why these kind of discussions are important. Now, this is a bit of a technical slide, but what it shows is if you take biological data, and so-called bionimbus, it's at where Grossman is at the University of Chicago, and you run a virtual machine, one of which is running on your computers in Chicago and one of which is EC2 in the Amazon Web Services, then as the size, this is a log scale, but the log is the size of the file. So the file goes up through a megabyte to 100 megabytes, you can see that the throughput in megabits per second gets up, and this is about half a gigabit per second. Now, one of the problems is that when you plug into EC2, you know, Amazon was never expecting to have to keep a 10 gigabit pipe full, so it doesn't have like Lustre parallel file systems and that sort of stuff. And that's what we're sort of challenging them to think about this, because there are lots of private sector companies who would, for backup reasons and all kinds of other reasons, want to be able to have this. In fact, they do have some of them, I'm told. Phil Papadopoulos, who's always been my architecture colleague at the San Diego Supercomputer Center on the OptiPuter and Quartzsite, a number of grants we've had, has been supported by the National Science Foundation to build out the ROCs software infrastructure. This is software that lets you automatically put up the software images you need across your cluster. There's several thousand clusters that use this now. It's probably the most widely used. You can build a cluster and have it up and running. Start from scratch with empty racks, build a cluster, say 128 node cluster, and be running application software in under 2 hours using ROCs. So a lot of people have ROCs, and so the question is, and this is one of the ways I think modalities you're going to see people moving to, I've got my local ROCs cluster, either in my chemistry department or on a campus colo. And ever so often, I need to have a lot more cycles. Well, wouldn't it be cool if this thing would just expand out into the cloud as needed? And yet I'd have the tightly coupled cluster locally, right? ROCs uses Xen, they use Xen, so it's possible. And the idea is you just continue to use your local cluster, but it automatically, without your having to do anything, can use the cloud. What this would mean is that your software that runs locally in your cluster would just automatically continue to run as you ended up with a lot more processors. Your home directory are mounted automatically in the cloud. Queue systems work, and MPI for parallel jobs would just continue to work as you grab more and more processors out of EC2 to add on, sort of bolt on to your cluster. So he's actually got this working now in principle, and he's got a ROCs role. So there's, let's just say you're doing electrostatic calculations in biology, biochemical work, and there's a particular adaptive Poisson-Boltzmann solver that there's a ROCs role for. ROCs software is distributed by ROCs roles. You can either get them on CDs or download them. Well, there's now an Amazon EC2 role and a Conda role. If you put them together, you then have your local cluster here extending out into the Amazon EC2 cloud with virtual machines sitting out in the cloud. And essentially, this whole thing is now running this adaptive Poisson-Boltzmann solver. So this is early days. Condor never dies. And is very useful in this context to essentially make a Condor flock that contains your cluster and things in the cloud. So I just bring this to your attention because I think a lot of people don't realize how far along this has gone, and it's going to be critical for you as you decide what to keep on campus and what to put out in the cloud. And the answer is you can do both. So let's think about the campus. For the last several years, starting about 08, UCSD committed itself at a very high level at a process driven by our Vice Chancellor of Research to work with the campus to come up with a plan for completely transforming UCSD's cyber infrastructure. And this includes co-location facilities, centralizing all the storage on campus, building out this 10 gigabit research network across the campus, having condo clusters that you can move your capability into out of the chemistry and physics departments, and working with the libraries to do digital curation, as well as developing a set of people who have skills in this area. The way I think about this is, because you've got now completely decentralized generation of data, anybody can get $500,000 in an NIH grant, can buy a next generation gene sequencer that turns out a terabyte a day per run. And they're sprinkled all over your campuses. And that's just the DNA sequencers. That doesn't include DNA arrays, MRIs, microscope, mass spec machines, etc. My sense of it is, what you need is kind of like a digital fabric, just like the shared internet is a fabric. But this is a research fabric that sits on your same optical fibers but is segregated from the shared environment. The way we got to this, we went out to a lot of our faculty, big centers, departments, and so forth, and said, what do you need that you don't have now to do your work, do your research? 80% of them said data backup, because people are able, by hook or crook, you know, to put FireWire between terabyte disk drives that they went down to Fry's to get, and then they sort of daisy chain these things around on their bookshelves and stuff. But there's no backup of any of this. You'd like a service. Think of, in the wall, there's the electrical outlet, fiber Cat 6, coax, and then there's an optical fiber that you plug into. That just handles all the backup automatically. They wanted to store large amounts of data. They want it preserved for a long time. And fundamentally, they can't do it because the network at a shared level can't handle it. They need a dedicated network. Well, fortunately, our Vice Chancellor of Research decided this was a strategic project because it was going to transform the platform of essentially what all research at UCSD was done. So he took the lead, Art Ellis, on this. We got some detailed case studies from the biologist and the seismologist, et cetera, et cetera. And then Mike Norman and Phil Papadopoulos chaired it, but we had faculty from the theater department to engineering and staff, and this was the critical thing, mixing both the faculty and staff, besides SDSC and Cal IT2, the libraries and the campus computing and telecom people. And then they sat for hours and hours and hours and hours for months and months and months and months working this through. In the meantime, we were fortunate enough, in addition to the Optiputer, to get a $2 million MRI grant, instrumentation grant, and we built out a core switch, which has, in addition to the border router, this is contained in Cal IT2, it's a router, a 10 gigabit switch, so you just switch from building coming in here to building going out there without having to go through the electronics, just to keep it in light, and then a wavelength selective switch, so you can literally switch the wavelength on the fiber from a flow on this wavelength to flow on this wavelength. Well, as a result, we now have 60 10 gigabit clear channels across the campus, and there's a variety of them. They're packet switched, some are switch wavelengths, about 300 endpoints, and this thing is somewhere between a half a terabit per second and a terabit per second. But the point is that an end user can select whether they want to have a routed path or a switched point-to-point path by software control, just on the fly. We're then going around, because we think the biomedical folks are the ones that have the biggest data tsunami, and so we've gone around and found where all the shared core instruments are, the microscopy facilities, the genome sequencers, and so forth. We've gone down and looked where the fiber is. We have fiber to the buildings in most cases, but not necessarily in the buildings, into the lab, into where the instrument is. And that's the part where I go around to campuses that's most missing. Now we have an architecture to invert the current way that most campuses are, where they have all these individual faculty clusters and storage and so forth, to invert that into a recentralization so that you have what I call a digital aquifer under the, you know, quadrangle. So there's this one massive multi-petabyte rotating storage, which we call Data Oasis, that has both parallel file service for high I/O as well as regular. And then in the labs, you have like these optiportals. Occasionally, you'll have a large cluster that does make sense out in the campus. All the digital transformation of the library is hooked into this, all the scientific instruments, and then SDSC has set up something like 50 racks for a cluster and storage condo, and then, as I'll show you in just a minute, we have very specialized data analysis facilities, Triton and Gordon. Triton has three components. One is just very large scale, 2 petabytes rotating storage that everything you put on is replicated and so forth. And then if you get money in a grant to get, you know, a 64 processor cluster, instead of buying that, you buy 64 processors on the shared condo, and then that's professionally managed, being kept up to date, that sort of thing. But then we have these very large memory data analysis machines, currently upwards of a half a terabyte of RAM, that you can put a large amount of data into. People say, well, isn't switching this stuff pretty expensive? 5 years ago when we started, yeah, it was $80,000 a port for a 10 gigabit. It's currently $400. So that's the kind of incredible decrease in price. Andy Bechtolsheim, who was, you know, one of the founders of Sun Microsystems, one of the great hardware architects in the United States, perhaps the best, has this new company called Arista that is doing many different 10 gigabit ports, because 10 gigabits, after all, are pretty much a commodity these days. So as a result, we have the Arista switch that we can then hook into the Tritons that I showed you, and a Gordon, the data analysis super computer I'm going to talk about in a minute. Dash is its sort of younger brother. So here's 110 gigabits coming into Gordon, 8 going into Dash, 32 going into Triton, 24 going over into the existing storage. We are able to move data in and out using Lustre parallel file system at 40 gigabytes. That's 320 gigabits per second. And there's a lot of replication going on as well. So how do you analyze data in this case? Well, you know, I've spent a lot of my life in high-performance computing. I founded and ran for 15 years the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at Illinois. And so we've sort of come to think of high-performance computing as what high-performance means. But actually, architecturally, if you are wanting to analyze data, you optimize differently. So instead of optimizing for peak floating-point operations, you optimize for I.O. per second, because if you can't get the data in and out of this thing, it doesn't matter how fast the computer is. Mike Norman, the cosmologist, but you know, is now also leader of SDSC, pulled together in one a proposal for the Track 2 supercomputer competition. Dash, as I said, is a small version of it, and the big guy is coming next year. Here's how to think about it. What's the problem? The problem is that if you've got data on disk, disk are about 100 times slower than RAM, okay, at getting data in and out of the processor. That's a pretty big jump. Flash memory is only 10 times slower than RAM. So if you can put enough flash memory in this thing, then you've got a logarithmic cache from the disk to the flash to the RAM, and you can keep the RAM full, particularly if the RAM is several terabytes of RAM. So 1,000 times larger than what I've got on my PC. And so this thing has something like a quarter of a petabyte of flash memory. There's nothing on the planet that has this much flash memory. So what you're doing is you're emphasizing memory and I.O. in its architecture and virtual shared memory so that you can accelerate access to massive databases, which are being generated in all these different fields. And then you've got this halt on the 10 gigabit infrastructure I talked about. If you have the 10 gigabit infrastructure to your scientist on your campus, and they go through the National Lambda Rail and into this, this looks like it's in their laboratory. And if you don't have it, then you're putting them at a great disadvantage compared to their competitors who do. Not unlike the way it was in 1985 when some of the universities said, we're not so sure we should dig up our quads and put in this internet thing. It might be a passing thing. The ones that did kept the best faculty. The ones that didn't lost their best faculty. And that was a very interesting period, 85 to 90, and I was there. So the sort of things that will be the hot applications are things like the de novo genome assembly. In other words, when you get this terabyte of sequencing out of genome sequencer, you have to then reconstruct what was the DNA. So what you'd like to do is just throw all of that terabyte up into the RAM and then reassemble it in RAM 100 times faster than you're used to doing it over disk. The same goes for analyzing all the data that comes from these cosmological simulations because you have this very large memory. Also, federations of databases around the country will be able, whether it's drug discovery or social science, will be able to benefit from the flash. So this is my last slide. We're having a big Woodstock of people who care about data-intensive computing in a few weeks at San Diego. We're bringing in the experts from all over the country who are sort of the pioneers of this new wave, not of high-performance computing, but high-performance data. And I'm going to spend all 3 days there. We're going to get, I think, a lot of better insight of how this will be transforming to science. But I hope this is giving you an insight that this is a step function. This is probably the biggest change in 20 years in cyber infrastructure. It's not incremental to what you're doing. It's a radical disruption to what you're doing. But a number of campuses are moving quickly in this direction, and I hope that you'll consider that yourself.
You can find more EDUCAUSE podcasts by visiting our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. EDUCAUSE podcasts are now available to listen to straight from your mobile device. Just visit www.educause.edu/mobile. I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.